So there are two things. There is a statement in the Gemara generally. Now this may not apply to the Pope because he's a religious leader, but there is a statement that says that one should endeavor to visit and to show respect even to the non-Jewish kings, because by understanding the glory and the honor of the non-Jewish king, we get a little taste of what the Melech HaMashiach is going to be. So if, for example, this would have been a foreign dignitary, let's say the President of the United States or Queen Elizabeth or the like, the answer, I think, would have been explicit based on the Gemara that one should kind of be excited. Now, the problem is, of course, that the Pope happens to be a head of state. Vatican City is actually a nation with its own currency and its own little army, the Swiss Guards and the like. And the Pope is head of state, but he is also the head of a religion that, according to many views, is idolatrous, the Catholic Church, based on the Trinity. So one would think, on some level, that it's not proper to give honor or glory to an Oved Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, let me remind you of the view of Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, one of the greatest Gedolim, who took the position that for a Christian, Christianity is not idolatry, meaning it is not a violation of the Noahide law. It would be idolatry for a Jew to practice that religion. It is not idolatrous for a Christian. Now the Rambam argues, the Rambam took the position that Islam was monotheistic, and Christianity, which was only Catholicism then, was polytheistic. But Rabbeinu Tam took a different position, and Rabbeinu Tam actually knew more Christians than the Rambam, living in France. So I think under these circumstances, in the interest of shalom and creating a good atmosphere, one would be allowed to give the Pope a welcome. This Pope in particular, putting aside the Christian belief, seems to be an unusually moral person in many, many ways. He is, wants to give up the wealth and the gashmius of the Catholic Church and the like. So if there's anyone, any non-Jew that's entitled to a certain amount of respect, I would think that this would be someone. Now, why is he coming Yom Yerushalayim? That's a very, very interesting point. I assume that's when he was invited. Now it's interesting that... he's not going to be here for Yom Yerushalayim. Well, okay. Because the Vatican still has not recognized, that's right, the Vatican. No, but I understand that the Vatican to this day has not recognized Jerusalem as the capital. I think it's still. He is officially going to do it. Okay, so we'll have to see. Okay, all right. In Yitzhak Hashem, I'll just say, again, I don't want to talk the whole share, but, yeah. Yeah.
They had a Last Supper. Having a meeting or a mass, I don't know what, that woman coming, the whole building.
Listen, we're not, we still live in Golis. Yerushalayim is filled with Christian shrines. In fact, that's why some Hasidim preferred living in Tel Aviv, rather be in a place that's godless than in a place of idolatry. And that was actually a cheshbon that some have made. So once again, I think this is a reminder that we are still in Golis. The Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt. Mashiach has not come yet. And this, I think, is something we should think about in a sober way. Be'ezras Hashem, Mashiach can come still today and certainly tomorrow, and perhaps the whole question will be rendered moot. But, once again, I don't think it's necessarily so productive to make a protest on these things. This is what it means to be in Golis, even in Yerushalayim. And as a result, this is what it is. And our response should be the tefillah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bring Geula, and all of these things would then get resolved in a good way. The protests, I think, just create a tremendous chilul Hashem and very, very bad feeling. And we do live in a world where we actually need the goodwill of the non-Jewish world to the degree that we can get it without compromisables. It's a reality of living in Golis, and we have to always remember that.
We can't give them cake of
dough. Can't. Well, we can't get. Yeah, I understand. I understand. But okay. But be it as it may, going back to the Chumash itself, we began yesterday the fourth book of the Chumash, the fourth book of the Torah, and in Hebrew the name of that book is Bamidbar, which simply means in the desert. But everyone knows that the English rendition of the book is Numbers, and in fact that is the rabbinic rendition of the book. According to Chazal, the name of the fourth Chumash is Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of Census. I think the plural of census may be sensai, as opposed to censuses, but be it as it may, there's a good reason why Chazal call it the book of census, or the book of countings, or the book of numbers, because it begins with a counting of the Jewish people, and who were 20 and up, and these are the people who left Mitzrayim, and towards the end of the book, in the book of Bamidbar, after the 40 years, after the old generation died, and it's a new generation that is entering the land of Israel, there is a second counting in Parshas Pinchas. So the beginning of the Chumash is census number one, and the end of that Chumash is census number two. It's a different generation. Census number one are the people who left Mitzrayim. Census number two are the people who are entering Eretz Israel. We're not going to talk about it today, but I'll just mention the fascinating thing to look at, and you should sit down at some point and compare your numbers, and that is the totals of the two countings are exactly the same, but the individual tribes shift considerably. So it's interesting, all sorts of changes occur, but the bottom number is the same. But coming back to this first census of Yotzei Mitzrayim, the census of those who have left Mitzrayim, so Rashi asks two questions. Question number one, why is there a need to count them again? They were counted when they left Mitzrayim. Why count them again? So Rashi offers an interpretation which we'll elaborate upon, that multiple repetitive countings is derech chiba. It is an expression of divine affection for the Jewish people. The mashal that the Medrash gives, just as a miser that is infatuated with money or gold or silver or jewels will keep on counting and counting and counting and counting, although he knows exactly what is there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu likes to count, 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 as if to say, I want to know how many Jews are there. I want to know how many Jews left Mitzrayim. I want to know how many Jews survived the Ego. Before we build a Mishkan and the Shekhinah will rest on the nation, I want to know how many there are. And indeed, that is actually the theme of the Haftorah. Just to digress for a moment, the Haftorah is the story of Hosea. And this is a very, very dramatic story. It's a machlokas. Was it a dream or an actual story? It's a machlokas Rishonim. But Hosea is told to marry a prostitute. Now, what on earth is going on with that? So the Gemara gives us some of the backstory, which would explain this strange event. And Hosea is arguing with Hashem. And Hosea says, you know, if the Jewish people are so unfaithful, if the Jewish people are so sinful, if the Jewish people are so bad, get rid of them. Unlike Moshe Rabbeinu, by the way, where the Cheder Ego, when Hashem wanted to get rid of us, Moshe Rabbeinu said, if you get rid of them, you get rid of me. Hosea actually said to Hashem, get rid of them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to teach Hosea, you know, it isn't so easy. Hosea marries a prostitute. She continues to be unfaithful. She's mezana. She commits adultery. She has no commitment to her husband. And Hosea is supposed to divorce her. But Hosea says, I can't. I love her too much. Hashem says, now you see my problem. You see, it's exactly it. Hosea has to understand that sometimes a connection can be so deep that even when there's unfaithfulness, there will be forgiveness. Now, as I say, in the case of Hosea, there's a halachic problem. If a woman is mezana, they're not allowed to stay married. So many Rishonim, the Abarbanel, they understand this to be a dream. It was not some, it was a prophetic dream. It was not something Hosea actually did, but it was a way of Hashem communicating to him that Hashem's love for the Jewish people is so deep and unconditional that even when we are unworthy, Hashem is not going to reject us. In fact, the Maharal says that the Bechira of Am Yisrael, it's very interesting. People ask a question, you know, Hashem appears to Avram when he's 75 and says, go to the land that I am going to show you, and I will make a covenant with you, and you will be a great nation. Now, if all you did was read the Chumash, and you would ask the question, why did Hashem choose Avram? You actually have no answer whatsoever. Now, good. The Medrash tells us Avram recognized Hashem at the age of 3, and that Avram was willing to be thrown into the fiery furnace, and Avram gave his life, right? Those are good reasons. But the Chumash itself does not say. If we had asked the question, according to the literal wording of the Torah, why did Hashem choose Avram? The answer is, no reason. Now, the Maharal, who of course always affirms that the traditions of our Chachamim are true, says, of course Avram was chosen for his righteousness, for his goodness, for his greatness. But why does the Torah not emphasize that? So this is what he says. If the Torah would have said, Avram is chosen because of his righteousness, that could give rise to the idea that Hashem's relationship to us is conditional. Avram was chosen because he was righteous. When we become not righteous, God can drop us. So the Torah wanted to communicate the idea of an unconditional relationship. And therefore, it gives no reason. So as a result, there's never anything you can say that would say that God will drop us because we don't have that reason. So yes, the Maharal says, this is a perfect example of how Chazal are right, and the literal meaning of the Chumash is also right. Certainly, Hashem had a reason for choosing Avram. But the Torah communicates it as if there's no reason to emphasize the unconditionality, if there is such a word, of the election of Am Yisrael. And that is what Hosea had to learn by this painful personal experience, or at least dream experience, in which he couldn't let go of someone that he loved and cared about. Right, so going back to Rashi, so Rashi says repetitive counting is a sign of chiba, a sign of affection, a sign of love, a sign of commitment. Hashem loves Am Yisrael. Yeah.
Wasn't the second counting before they entered Canaan because of first of all, of the males between 20 and 60,
yeah,
to see who would be serving in the army, and
well, it was primarily
who would get
the Nachal and Eretz Yisrael. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
For the first counting.
Yeah.
Was that everybody who left Mitzrayim, or was it just the 20?
No, it's the same thing. Same 20. Yeah, same thing. Same age group.
There has to be something significant about 20 to 60, because in the Midbar, being 20 really had, what was the significance? It wasn't for how many people.
Number one, keep in mind. Number one, there were wars in the Midbar. That's correct. The War of Midian was in the Midbar, but even earlier wars. Amalek was in the Midbar. Amalek was the first war we had. But keep in mind that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to set us up for failure. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a plan that had there not been the Chet HaMeraglim, we would have gone with that group. That group would have entered Eretz Yisrael, you see. So in a sense, even though Hashem knew the future, but he set up at least the possibility of coming. By the way, the common statement 20 to 60 is actually not explicit in the Torah. What the Torah says is you're counted from 20 and up. It does not explicitly say 60, and we know that all the Chet HaMeraglim was the age group of 20 to 60. Some commentaries actually assert that the census embraced everybody from 20 up. Others do say 20 to 60. So remember that the 60 year limit is not explicit in the Chumash. Alright, so Rashi says the multiple counting is because of derech, chiba, affection and love. But then Rashi asks another kasha. And that is, the males got counted when they hit their 20th birthday. Now, here's the problem. When was this counting in the beginning of Bamidbar? The Torah says it was the month of Eor, of the second year of the Exodus, from the Exodus, meaning it was exactly 1 month after the Mishkan was dedicated. The Mishkan was dedicated Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which is the beginning of the second year, because in Torah chronology, the years switch in Nisan, not in Tishrei. And therefore it's Echad Lachodesh Hasheni L'Shana Hashenis. The first of the second month, the second year. Now, we know that after Yom Kippur, go back to the preceding Yom Kippur, Moshe comes down with the second Luchos, and that is when Klal Yisrael is forgiven, and that's when they begin to build the Mishkan, and that's when they gave the half shekels that were melted down for the sockets, and that's when they were counted the first time, and that's also 603,000, 100,000, and the question is, Rashi says, didn't anybody have a birthday? So, the first counting was after Yom Kippur. We don't know exactly, but between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. The second counting is Rosh Chodesh Iyar. It's exactly the same number. Didn't anybody become 20 years old between those two countings? Because if anybody became 20 years old, the second minyan should have been more. So there are a lot of answers that are given. Some say, well, maybe the extra people who became 20 were equally balanced, perhaps by death, and perhaps by people hitting 60. So the people who became 20 were balanced by the people who hit 60. That's one answer. The Or HaChaim suggests that the first census included the tribe of Levi. The second census specifically does not include the tribe of Levi. So if the two numbers are the same, the population growth in the second minyan would be equal to the number of Levim who were excluded in that, they were included in the first, excluded in the second. But Rashi gives another answer. Rashi gives a very surprising answer. Rashi says that birthdays in the Midbar were not individual birth dates, but they were lockstep birth dates. Every Rosh Hashanah, you became 1 year older. As a result, even if you were born Elul, you were born the end of Elul, when Rosh Hashanah came, you were assigned 1 year old. I believe they do that in China, I think, and I know they do that for racehorses. That's right. Lahavdil, of course. not the Jewish Rosh Hashanah. I just meant to say that I think January 1st or whatever the date is. Yep. That's right. That's correct. So Rashi makes the ingenious point: if you don't become 1 year old until Rosh Hashanah, between Yom Kippur and Iyar, nobody had a birthday. Meaning, whoever was halachically 20 years old was 20 years old the preceding Rosh Hashanah. So they were 20 the first counting by Yom Kippur, and they were still 20 the second counting, because they wouldn't become 20 till next Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. Now, this is a big chiddush, really, because it's very unusual that Rosh Hashanah should be significant. In the Midbar, after all, the years change in Nisan. But Nisan wouldn't help Rashi, because if Nisan was when you became a year older, between Yom Kippur and Iyar, there is a Nisan. So Rashi is forced by this biblical text to say that although the national dating of Am Yisrael was based on Nisan, but individual birthdays were computed based on Tishrei. This is what Rashi says. Okay. But I want to go a little further with this, and that is, so be it as it may, the Jewish people are counted twice in the span of 6 months. The first time, when the Mishkan is being built in the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel, when they give the half shekel. The second time, 1 month after Hakamas HaMishkan, 1 month after the Mishkan is put up. If you look at the two countings, you see some striking differences, although the totals are the same indeed. Counting number one is a very anonymous counting. We know in the book of Shmos, through the half shekel, that there were 603,000 men from the age of 20 up, but we don't know the tribal division. We don't know how many Reuvens, how many Shimons. We don't know. It's an anonymous collective counting, and it's a counting through just counting coins in a pushka. People put money in a coin, in coins. Moshe Rabbeinu counts the coins. We know how many people there are. By contrast, the counting in the book of Bamidbar is not only a total, it is a tribal breakdown. How many Reuvens? How many Shimons? Now, there is a machlokas, by the way. Was it a counting by a half shekel or not? But even if it was a half shekel counting, it was not simply dropping it in the box. They had to have a record of which tribes, huh?
Didn't say that Moshe said, how am I going to count them? Hashem said, you do your job, I'll do mine. He stood by the house, and then he was able to...
That's Levium. But still, I mean, even if they were counted individually, the problem is, the Torah says in Kisisa that first counting is through half shekel. And that half shekel was not used for sacrifices. That half shekel was melted down for the sockets of the Mishkan. The Torah says that. However, there is an annual mitzvah of half shekel that is used for sacrifices, and Rashi himself says that was the half shekel that was given in the second counting, and that was the contribution that was used for the buying of the korbanos. Now there is, of course, a problem that you have a break of 1 month. I mean, the Mishkan was dedicated Rosh Chodesh Nisan. People didn't give the half shekel of the korbanos till Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Who paid, so to speak, for the first month korban tamid and the korban musaf? Now you can't just have private donations. The halacha is the communal offerings of the Beis HaMikdash have to come from publicly collected money. It has to come from a machzis hashekel tax, and our problem basically is that the machzis hashekel tax did not kick in, according to Rashi, till the ER census. What do you do for the month of Nisan?
Put it on
credit card. Right? Okay. Yep.
Technically, if they counted people until 60, let's say,
yeah,
and they still stayed another 39 years in the Midbar,
yeah,
there could have been people 99 years old who were counted for the Tzavah to go into Eretz.
Well, remember, remember, they died, meaning to say, the generation that died in the desert was between the age of 20 and 60. So, as a result, anybody that's 20 would die by age 60. That's exactly the 40 years. Except for Kalev, of course, Yeshua and Kalev, there was nobody over the age of 60 that entered, except for women. There were women. Righteous women could have been, huh? There were no men. There were women who certainly could have entered Eretz, who did enter Eretz Yisrael. So there's a machlokas if that second census had a half shekel or not. But the one thing that's very certain is, even if it had a half shekel, it was not an anonymous counting, because there was a tribal breakout, which there was not in the first minyan. This is very important. The minyan in the book of Shemos does not give you a tribal number of anything. The minyan in Bamidbar is the first time in the Torah that we have a tribal breakdown. We'll come back to that. Moreover, there's another difference, at least based on Ramban. When the Torah describes the counting, the Torah uses the phrase mispar shemos. Now the word mispar or lisaper or lispor, in other words, a shorish samach pei resh, can possibly mean two things. Lispor is to narrate. I'm sorry, lispor is to count, rather. Lisaper is to narrate. So does mispar shemos mean the counting of names? You count? Or does it mean the narration of names? So most translations will say the counting of names, counting of people. But Ramban says a beautiful, beautiful thought. Ramban says it actually means narrating your name. That when you gave the Machzis HaShekel, you went over to Moshe Rabbeinu and you introduced yourself. Which is pretty amazing, because if you think about it, Moshe Rabbeinu was, of course, the greatest Navi and was the leader of a nation of 3 million people, if you include the women and the people below 20 and over 60. And Moshe Rabbeinu had the responsibility of taking us out of Mitzrayim and Matan Torah and the Man, all of those things. But how many people got to know him individually? You know, Aaron had more of that role. Aaron was the marriage counselor. Aaron was the Oev Shalom, Barodev Shalom, the pursuer of peace. But Moshe Rabbeinu had to deal with the nation. Moshe Rabbeinu was not necessarily involved. If you had a Shalom Bayis problem, you couldn't say, let's have an appointment with Moshe Rabbeinu. You couldn't get it. I mean, listen, even in our generation, with our Gedolim, right? One minute here, 2 minutes here. Moshe Rabbeinu's time was even more taken up. And yet, there's a sakana that when one is the leader of a nation, he can sometimes forget that each individual in that nation matters as well. As they say, you can't just be a leader of Am Yisrael, you have to help Reb Yisrael, the individual Jew. So the Ramban says it was extremely important that at least one time in somebody's life, they personally introduce themselves to Moshe Rabbeinu. So they're no longer a faceless anonymity, but they are a discrete individual. That's important for Moshe Rabbeinu, and of course it's important for the person who's doing it. And the Ramban says, that is the meaning of the phrase, Mispar Shemos. Give Moshe Rabbeinu your name. Now I do know the mathematicians in the audience, if there are any, will start computing, well gee, if you have 603,000 people that have to make these introductions, even if you assume a 15-second introduction, it's going to take months, and you know it takes a real long time. You know there's going to be a problem. Okay, but everything Derech Neis, obviously, the whole minyan was with Derech Neis, and time was accelerated or whatever it would be. But Moshe Rabbeinu had to know people's names, and again, Moshe Rabbeinu perhaps he remembered those names. We don't know. So the pattern that emerges is the first minyan was collective, anonymous, aggregate total. The second minyan had a much more individualistic, particularistic aspect, both in terms of shvatim and in terms of the individual himself, according to the Ramban's understanding of the phrase Mispar Shemos. What does that signify, and why are there two minyanim within 6 months of each other which reflect these different aspects of community? And the suggestion is, all of us know, we talked about this before, that the idea of machzis ha-shekel, giving a half shekel instead of a whole shekel, which by the way is much, much more than our half shekel, but giving the half shekel is a remez to community, because the idea is you're incomplete. A half is considered to be a fraction, something incomplete, unless it connects to another, right? So Machzis HaShekel is about Achdus, about community. But there are two types of communities that can exist in the world. There are two ways of forming community. One way might be called a melting pot, and one might be called salad bowl, or mosaic, or symphony, or tapestry, or multiculturalism. Again, we'll talk about it. Now, melting pot was, let's say in the United States, in the early decades of the 20th century, no more, was the dominant model of how people from different cultures come in. The idea of a melting pot is that in order to create a cohesive, unified community, people have to set aside their differences. People have to melt, kind of give up their language, give up their culture, kind of just meld. It's similar, you know, not to use an totally unappetizing metaphor, but consider what Cholent looks like, you know, Monday morning or Monday night. You can't really tell the distinct ingredients anymore. It all kind of just becomes a glop, as it were. And that is the strength of that model is that creates a unity in which people can be fixated and even obsessed on achieving a common goal, but at the expense of destroying their individuality and their uniqueness. So minion number one, now I'll discuss why we have two. Minion number one represents a model of Achdus where we don't care about the Reuvens and the Shimons and the Esthers and the Devorahs of the world. We just care about Klal Yisrael. It's anonymous, it's a single nation, it's an indivisible force. That is minion number one. The minion of anonymity, the minion of submerging your individuality in the collective mass for the glory of Hashem and the strengthening of the nation. Minion number two is very different. Salad bowl, right? Look at a salad, right? So salad, different textures, different colors, different tastes. And the beauty lies precisely in the mixture of all of these different elements, in which each element has its own contribution. And again, you can use a lot of metaphors. You want to use a food metaphor, call it a salad. You can talk about the beauty of a tapestry is in the different colors, mosaic. The Medrash actually uses the mashal of a flower garden. A melech gets much more pleasure from a garden that has different colored flowers than one flower just endlessly repeating. Music is certainly that way. Although there might be some New Age composers that may repeat the same notes over and over and over and over and over again. To a normal person, the beauty of music lies precisely in the amalgamation of differences, different pitches, different rhythms, and putting them together, there is something beautiful that is created. Now, and that's why Shvatim are a big deal, because, you know, the Torah clearly makes a big deal about tribes. You know, every tribe has its own flag. Every tribe has its own place in the camp. Every tribe has its own president. That's what the Nasi is. The tribes have their distinct portions in Eretz Yisrael. And there was even a halacha, although it wasn't permanent, that if a woman inherited property from her father because there were no sons, and she's from one shevet, she's not allowed to marry a man from another shevet, because that would be transferring property from one tribe to another. Huh? No, I said it was not a permanent halacha, but that was a halacha initially when Eretz Yisrael was divided. Now you might ask yourself, why are tribes a big deal? Of course, today we don't even have that consciousness because we don't even know our tribes except for Kohanim and Levim. We're one nation. We're Am Yisrael. Why is it important to have a sense of identity of Yisachar and Zebulun and Reuven and Shimon? Tribes seem to be introducing divisions as opposed to the undifferentiated unity. We are one nation. And the answer is no. We are one nation. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically wanted a type of nation in which each tribe has its own uniqueness, right? Yisachar was the tribe of full-time Torah. Zebulun was commerce to service Yisachar. And we don't have a tremendous deep sense. One can write a whole book on this, and books have been written on it. How each tribe had a different derech in Avodas Hashem. Hashem does not want a community based on conformity and sameness. Hashem wants a community based on diversity and difference, and that becomes beautiful. That is the glory of Hashem. Now, of course, as we see in secular society, the United States, and even more so Europe, where you have multiculturalism, what eventually can happen is, if everybody's doing their own thing, there is no sense of commonality, there is no sense of unity. But the answer is, yes, we have our 12 Shvatim, but they're all surrounding the Mishkan, which is their common core, meaning we have a common mission. Torah, mitzvos, serving Hashem. That is our mission statement. That is our goal. But we do so not by sameness. We do so by the beauty of all of the divergent approaches. So if it's Ashkenazim and Sfardim and Hasidim and Misnagdim and Balei Musar and those who serve Hashem primarily by Torah and those who serve Hashem by Gemilas Chasadim or Tefillah, And within Torah, there are so many different ways of learning, and those who serve Hashem in the economic marketplace. All of them have their makam, all of them have their significance, all of them have their role. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's desire that people express their personalities in different ways. Now, of course, I mean, of course, within the common commitments of Torah and mitzvahs. If a person doesn't accept Torah and mitzvahs, then we still love them and try to be makarev, indeed, but we, you know, don't consider that to be a legitimate expression of community. So, in Bekitzur, minyan number one represents melting pot community. Minyan number two represents salad bowl community. So why do you have both countings? Minyan number one was in the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel. Right? It was the response after Yom Kippur. The Chet HaEgel was an extremely precarious, cataclysmic time for Am Yisrael. Hashem wanted to destroy the Jewish people. We were hanging by a thread. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "Leave me alone, so I will destroy this people, and I will make you a great nation." Moshe Rabbeinu didn't accept the deal. Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Forgive them, or mecheni na misifrecha, erase me from your book." So the lesson of the first minyan is this. When Klal Yisrael is facing a sakana, when they have to recover from a tragedy, think about the aftermath of the Holocaust. It isn't time to focus on your idiosyncrasies and emphasize your individuality and march to the beat of a different drummer. There's a time in which you gotta put all the differences aside and work for a common goal. You know, it's interesting, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, even in terms of marriages, you know, normally a person might want to marry, you know, a courtship or, you know, love somebody. And that, there were people who were willing to marry, like, the first situation that came along. They felt so important. It was so imperative to build families, to build Am Yisrael. Again, whether that's correct or not, I don't know. But Baruch Hashem, it largely worked. Even though it seems like a bit of a drastic step to make. But when a person knows, I have to build the nation, I have to build my family, I have to recreate, and I will make it work with whomever I attach myself to. And Baruch Hashem, it had much, much hatzlacha in that way. So in the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel, we're not interested in a Reuven, in a Shimon, in a Yisachar, or a Zebulun. We have to have Klal Yisrael. It's necessary, but it's not the ultimate goal. It is a temporary measure that needs to be replaced and supplanted by a deeper, more meaningful level of community. A community that understands that people are different. They have different pathways in Avodas Hashem. And those pathways need to be cherished and nurtured and encouraged. And community does not mean conformity, it does not mean sameness. But there can be, it's precisely the beauty of the differences that make a community great and make it a source of Kiddush Hashem and make it a source of Nachas Ruach to the Ribono Shel Olam. And thus, that's what Rashi means. After the Chet HaEgel, they're counted. And then, Kishaba Lahashros Shechina Beinehim. When Hashem is going to rest His divine presence, meaning to have that permanent relationship with Hashem, you need the concept of Shvatim. And the Ramban would add, you even need the concept of the individual. This is, you know, an important lesson. Machlokes in Klal Yisrael, in the sense of different approaches to Avodas Hashem, is not a chisaron, it is a strength. Because there are many, many ways that can bring a person to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and each person has a different approach. This is what Yom Gaon says in Mishlei. Chanoch lenar al pi darko. You train a child according to his way. Every child has his or her way of learning Torah, of relating to Hashem. And the goal of a parent and the goal of a mechanech is to discover the uniqueness of that particular child's approach. This is why, ideally, the original education of the Torah was really homeschooling. V'shinantam levanecha. Parent teaches child. You know, on one hand, we can boast that we were the first society in history that had compulsory elementary education. We set up compulsory during the Second Temple, during the Bayis Sheni, Yehoshua ben Gamla. Some say Shimon ben Shetach, but Yehoshua ben Gamla, the Gemara, the Babli says Yehoshua ben Gamla, the Yishami says Shimon ben Shetach, set up a compulsory school system that had to be financed by the community, like public schools, by the way. In other words, it wasn't tuition, where if you sent your kid, you paid tuition. Rather, the community had to pay for schools, and we're very proud of that. This is the first time in history that there was compulsory education. But if you look at the Gemara, it is actually described as a failure, a second best option, because parents were no longer able to adequately teach their children in many cases, so nebuch, we had to have a school. We had to have a yeshiva. But the yeshiva katana, let's say, or a cheder. Cheder, is only really talking about cheder. Advanced yeshivas, there always were. But the notion of a cheder, the original idea was, b'shinantim levanecha. I would teach my children how to read, I would teach them chumash, and then if they went out, if they had to work, they worked. If they were able to go to yeshiva, they went to yeshiva. But when that became not possible for everybody, we had to create schools. But why is a school a second best? Because a school, by definition, you cannot have a one-to-one ratio. A school, by definition, the best intention school, and I'm not saying anything negative about chinuch, but the best intention school has to pitch to kind of an imaginary average, in which actually it may be pitching to nobody. In other words, either an average, or you pitch to the best, or you pitch to the worst. I mean, whatever way you want to adjust it, somebody's best needs are not being met. Right? The brightest is being kept behind. The slowest may not be able to keep up. Some hypothetical average is going to dissatisfy both ends of the spectrum. And yet, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko stresses the idea of individuality. But again, I want to emphasize, although my example might be academic ability, but I don't mean to suggest that the only factor of individuality is, you know, how good you are academically. People have different personalities. Some need to play more. Some need to be physically involved. It is recorded that the Maharal had, certainly, the Maharal had a grandson or a great-grandson, I'm not sure of the Yichus anymore, who did not have what you call a Gemara head. For some reason, the abstract logic of Gemara was difficult for him. But he was a very talented person with his hands. And he became a silversmith. But the Maharal said, you know, there's so much Torah that you can learn based on your talents. So he had the person explore the details of the Mishkan and the details of the Beis HaMikdash. And through his hands, he was able to make scale models incorporating the different views of all the different Mefarshim, because this was the way he was able to process information, and therefore he actually learned many, many portions of Torah, which many people sometimes aren't able to learn. Sometimes you have the other way. Sometimes you have the very, very gifted abstract logician who does not have a good visual sense. And Badavka, when it comes to the parts of the Torah and the parts of Chazal that talk about spatial visualization, like many, many discussions of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash require some type of 3D visualization, they Badavka don't learn that. But the silversmith, the Maharal's great-grandson, was able to do that. So the notion is that Hashem wants us as individuals to come together. Yeah?
What about the girls?
Well, you know, again, I mean, whatever I'm saying applies equally with girls. And in fact, by the way, I would suggest, although I can't say, I don't have any daughters, so I can't say I know firsthand the chinuch, of course, even my son was not educated here. But in many ways, I think girls have less of a problem than boys, certainly, because being, you know, in a boys' yeshiva, basically, Gemara is 99.9% of what we learn. Everything else is very, very limited. Precisely because in the girls' seminaries, they don't, well, most do not learn Gemara, that frees them up for a whole bunch of things. There's more Tanakh, and there's more Hashkafa, and there's more history, and there's more Musar, and there's more Machshava. So if anything, a girl's educational experience is much more diverse, it's much more broad, and it can appeal to many, many different interests. Now, you may ask me, but what if a girl likes Gemara? Well, I don't want to get in trouble. Okay, but let me just say that there is adequate halachic koros that would permit a girl to kind of have private instruction in Gemara, provided it really should not be done in a big classroom setting. So if a woman desires to learn Gemara, there should be, and there are, avenues in which that can be indulged. And we have, you know, first of all, there's a legend, we're not sure if it's true, that Rashi did not have sons, Rashi had daughters, and that Rashi did learn, actually Beryl Wine shows it in his film, so it must be true, that Rashi sat and learned Gemara with his daughters. And there's even a tradition that one of the commentaries on Maseches Nazir was written by Rashi's daughter as opposed to Rashi. Now, I hope that's not the reason why it's not learned in yeshivas. It's interesting. I hope that's not the reason, but you know, who knows? That commentary people do not learn. But yeah, you say your father learned with you. Yeah, so I do want to point out that this may be a talk for another time, that even though there are halachic issues about women learning Gemara, that is primarily in a public classroom setting. There are certainly many, many makoros that there were individual women, very religious women, very righteous women, women of who were married to Gedolim and who themselves became great in Torah, who did learn many pieces of Gemara. In fact, there's an interesting story. There's a lot of stories I can tell you about this, but there's one story I know that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, his brother-in-law was Rav Shradron. He and Rav Shradron married sisters. And I think that was the relationship. And one time, Rav Shlomo Zalman was arguing with Rav Shradron over how to interpret a Tosos in Maseches Beah, which was relevant to Halacha Lemaisa. And they were arguing, and Rebbetzin Shradron came in, and she said she felt that they were misinterpreting what Tosfos says, and she offered her interpretation. And Rav Shlomo Zalman thought for a minute and said, "Rebbetzin is right. She is right. I made a mistake in that interpretation." You know, so all I'm saying is that whether that's the way it works in the real world, I can't tell you. But theoretically, the notion of accommodating individuality, I think women have, in some ways, more opportunities than men, because the men's yeshiva curriculum is so single-focused. Now, whether that's right or not, one could argue, but I think Rav Herschel Schechter in YU once said that he didn't understand why the more modern women are agitating to make seminaries like yeshivas. There ought to be movement to make yeshivas like seminaries, because the seminaries... Yeah, the seminaries actually have a better educational experience for many, many boys.
Yeah. My father was learning the halachas of Cheskes Kashrus.
Yeah.
The night before.
Right.
And I always took one course in Brooklyn College at night because that's when the yeshiva boys were there.
Okay.
Went during the day. But Chaim Lipton was in Barakway.
Right.
I used to get a ride home.
Right.
And those boys used to stop at this bagel place on going to the Marine Parkway Bridge. At this non-Shomer Shabbos bagel place, and they used to stop for bagels.
Right.
And I had just learned the Gemara the night.
Right.
So I gave him a whole argument why this guy had no Cheskes Kashrus, and they looked at me like, "Where do you come from?"
Where
you? And you know, whatever.
Well, yeah, you know, I was once at a Shabbos table, and obviously I do not try to invite confrontations. It wasn't me, but there were a bunch of guys who were talking about their yeshiva-type learning. So one of the women at the table just said, "You know, you guys don't learn any halacha at all. How do you know how to keep Shabbos? How do you know how to keep a kosher kitchen?" So they say, "When we get married, you know, our wives will tell us." You know, so that's an example. But the larger point, I want to leave you with is that indeed it is the beauty of Am Yisrael that we have all of these different streams, and that is the lesson in the two countings. Melting pots is a necessary short-term situation that sometimes must exist, but the ultimate in Achdus is the mosaic, is the beauty of the diversity which is organized along a common commitment of Torah and Mitzvahs. And we know, of course, as we prepare for Matan Torah, we have to be in unity, Ish Echad Uvalev Echad, and may we be zochet to have a unity that always appreciates the individuality of each individual that is a member of the club. So we have